I'm here in Saggart in the home of the Bradys, and I'm talking to Vera Crofton and Kit Brady and his wife Betty. Vera, where you lived and grew up here in Saggart, did you?
Yeah.
Whereabouts?
Mill Road, number 80 in Mill Road. And I lived with my grandparents. And I'm sure you don't want the history of that, do you? Or do you?
I do indeed. Yeah, I think that's just as important as any other history. Why your grandparents? Why not your own parents?
Well, my mother and father were married in 1939. Both of them were 23 years of age. He was very short time married when he was took very sick. In actual fact, she was pregnant when I was born, when she was married, and that was the biggest shame in the country at that time, as you know, and she had a hard time. And her aunt and uncle, who lived on the North Strand, were a great help to her, because the grandfather, her father, was very annoyed, and he can tell you that she was pregnant and going to marry this young man who looked very delicate. He was a lovely singer, and he came from Cabra, and he came out on his bike. Now, how she met him was, five doors from his house, my grandmother had a cousin living there, Maggie Farrell. And my dad and her eldest son were best friends. And the extraordinary thing was that they didn't live very long without each other. Because that guy married a few years after he married, he got TB as well, and he died. But to get back to my story, they got married in 1939. I was born in January. I'm not sure of the date of their wedding. I would imagine it was in the August. And by that time, my grandfather had reconciled, and he got the man who was the manager in the mill and very fond of photography, Mr. Gailey, did the wedding photographs. So I have quite nice wedding photographs and all that business. And the wedding party went to my mother's aunt, who was very good to her, out on the North Strand, into a little masonette type. You wouldn't call it a flat by today's standards. It would have been smaller, you know. And they had a little gathering there. And then the two of them went off the next day down to Thurles on the train for their honeymoon, and was back that evening.
Yeah.
So they had a bit of as Mother Dunger would say, a bit of an old jant on the train.
Yeah.
So that was when they got married, and I'd say that was about August 39. And then he became sick. He was working in the GPO, and he was studying, and he would have done well, because his brother, who was in the same position, ended up as a civil servant. And my grandmother would say, AB had to work for to get where he was, but Jack was able to do it without the bother. He was very bright. So anyway, he got this lump on his neck, and Sir Patrick Dunne's hospital had beds in it, belonged to the GPO. So he was lucky enough to be able to be taken into hospital, and they had a look at him. And they said they'd have to remove this lump on his neck. They removed that before I was born. I'd say they weren't too long married when that happened. And from there on, he didn't make progress. And 6 weeks after they took this off, they discovered that he had a TB gland, and that it was going down in his lungs. This TB was going into his lungs. And then he was sent out to Newcastle County Wicklow to a sanatorium. Yeah. And that, of course, was an excursion for my mother, who was at that time heavily pregnant with me, and she was scrubbing tenement houses in Rathmines, where they had a little flat of their own at this stage, to get a view Bob. And I remember her describing it to me that, you know, it meant hawking buckets of cold water from the yard up to the top of these apartments, which were 3 and 4 stories high, and she'd be scrubbing these floors after the builders.
My goodness, yeah.
Yeah, so she had a tough task, and she was carrying me at the same time. It's no wonder I'm a workaholic.
Yeah.
But I was born then in January, and they allowed him out of Newcastle, County Wicklow, for one visit. And she described to me how he came into the Rotunda Hospital to see me when I was about 3 or 4 days old. But he had to go back to the hospital that evening. And then in the June, now, because she had this bit of a job, my grandparents took me here to Saggart. And they, in actual fact, were very supportive of her when she was trying to look after me, you know, and when I came along. And they were very supportive of her when she was visiting the hospitals, and they were very good to dad, my dad. But anyway, that was, we'll say, we're now in January.
Yeah, but you were just a little baby at that stage. And
yeah.
So, and your grandparents took you over.
They took me over there.
And your mother, she was in... She was still working in the town doing small jobs,
scrubbing floors.
And did you have other a brother or sister?
No. I was the only child in that union.
Yeah.
And that was January 1940. My mother was working away, trying to earn a few bob, going out to visit my father, and my grandmother would go into town, and she'd get her shopping in Moore Street, and then she'd go up to visit my mother, and she'd always forget a bag that had a bit of meat and a few eggs and a half a dozen of snipes in it, as they called it then, Guinness with the three X's on it.
Oh yes, that's
that
right.
That was the invalid stout. She'd always forget them, and they'd be under the table, and that would be left for my mother to go visit Jack in and be able to take something to him and feed herself,
mm-hmm.
because she was paying rent. But anyway, in the June of 1940, they sent my father home from Newcastle, County Wicklow. He was 23 years old, and they said there was no way they could treat him. He was going to die. And when he came home, I saw him once. Well, he saw me once. But like my mother said, he didn't even open his eyes on that occasion. He kept them shut, and he kissed me on the forehead, and he said, "Take the child out of this room. She can't be in here." Now, he was in a very small little room in his mother's small house in Cabra. And he was the third eldest of 10 children.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they all had to squash up in the other two rooms, and the grandfather threw up a bit of a kind of a kitchen at the back.
Not much room.
Very, very little. If you know Cabra at all, or Ballyfermot, or any of those houses that were built at that time, they were small houses. And they all had to squash in because my father needed this room to come home to, and he couldn't come home to Saggart. He had to be near services of some description. And my mother gave up her job then, her little bit of a job cleaning, and she went to his mother's in Cabra, where they took care of him together. And
did she have any subsistence?
Absolutely nothing. She wasn't allowed to go back to her job because she had worked in Swiftbrook Paper Mills here, and she was in the envelope department at the
time. Why wasn't she allowed to go back to her job?
Because women were not allowed to go back. I didn't go back to my work when I was married in 1960.
Yeah.
So my mother certainly couldn't go back to work in 1940. So this is why, and the money she was earning was cash in the hand, because she wasn't employed and she wasn't paying a stamp, and she was entitled to nothing, and she'd no child allowance, and she had no widow's allowance. So she went in the June, and I was here in Saggart with my grandparents. She went in the June to live in Cabra with her mother-in-law to take care of her husband.
Yeah.
And now, mark you, they'd only been together for a few months before ever she, you know, was on her own with a child. But anyway, she was there from June until the 13th of August when he died, and she slept on a chair with a blanket around her.
For all that time?
For all that time, as they minded him. They had to lift him and change him, and he was dying for that time. So 3 days before he died, an ambulance came and took him to the Rialto end of Kevin's hospital it was then, it's James's now, but the Rialto end was the TB end, and that's where he died. And when he died, the only stipulation she had was that she wanted him to come home here to Saggart. So I have a legacy in Saggart. I have his grave.
Yeah.
And I buried my husband with him when he died 12 years ago. And please God, I'll end my old bones will be down there as well.
But go back and talk to me about the problems your mother had when...
Well, she had absolutely nothing. She had nothing. And then when he was dead and buried in the August of 1940, she came back out home to live with her parents. She couldn't get a job, and Horsburgs were the name of the people that owned the mill. And he, my grandfather worked there. He was a watchman. And he used to be chatting with Mr. Horsburgh. And of course, my grandfather was an ex-British soldier. He was in the 1914 Asian War. So Mr. Horsburgh, being an Englishman, he'd often stand and talk to him, which was great privilege them days, you know, if the boss was to talk to you. And he was an old so-and-so at the back of it. But having said that, he listened to the story about my mother, because I suppose the birds and the bushes, there was only very few people in Saggart at that time. Everybody was talking about Jack Rice.
Everybody knew everybody else's business, really.
Absolutely, and were very helpful to each other, yeah. All of them. And he offered my mother a job working in his house as a cook. And that's where she went to work, in the mill house. But she was only allowed to come out of work. She had to live in. And she was allowed to come out of work on a Wednesday afternoon to come down and see the child. Now, the child didn't live a half mile from her.
Yeah.
And they had a baby exactly the same age as mine, as I was. Dorothy was the same, well, she might have been a couple of months older than me. So we used to get the few clothes for me from there as well. So we were really beholden to this family, you know. Tipping the cap and what have you, you know.
Yeah.
And
well, they really did pull, you know, they
pulled her out of the fire, as the fella says, yeah. Yeah. So the following May, there was a bomb dropped on the North Strand. And the aunt and uncle, who were very supportive of my mother, and she would have said was our best friend in this life, were killed in the bombing. And that was Mary Duggan, who was married to John Forden. John Forden and Mary Duggan were killed on the North Strand. That was the last straw in my mother's... It was a nail in our coffin. She couldn't cope. She fell apart. And at that stage, my grandparents, her mother and father, said to her, look, you can go... She filled out papers to go to the front. She was going to France. She didn't care whether she lived or died. And she thought if she could be of service. Now, you know, I had a lot of issues with this all my life.
Was this brought on by maybe the bomb dropping?
Yeah.
That she wanted to,
she
some
wanted
revenge?
To do something, she wanted to help, and that was it. And as I say, I had huge issues with this all my life. I dealt with this when I was 54, and I had a nervous breakdown. But all my life, it was an issue for me. But she did. The grandfather wouldn't sign the papers for her to go to France, so she went to England. And my father's brother, Willie Rice, met her at New Street Station in Birmingham. And they had to stay on the station for 3 days and three nights because there was a blitz. And when she came off the station, Birmingham Central was flat. Flat as a pancake. And he took her to where he was in digs. And the woman there took her in and gave her digs there as well. And some years later, and I'm not sure how many years, I would think it's about 4 years later, she married this woman's brother from the house where she was in digs.
Yeah.
Bill Freeman.
Oh, where the two of you were being looked after at home now by your grandparents?
No, just me. She was
just
gone.
You. Yes.
It was just me here in Saggart with my grandparents.
You had another sister?
No.
No. Oh, sorry.
Willie Rice, my father's brother, met her in Birmingham. And that's when they had to stay on the station because of the blitz. And when they came off the station, place was flat. So wherever she was going to go, she had nowhere to go. And Willie took her to his digs, you know, and he was her brother-in-law. So he was going out with a girl he married later on, and they went to America. But he set her up in the digs, and as I say, she married Bill Freeman then. But what she did then, she got a job straight away, because they were really looking for labour, and there wasn't a man in sight. You know, this is the 1939-45 war.
Yeah, war
so,
years. Yeah,
so we're talking 41 here.
Yeah.
1941. And she got a job in the BSA factory on Dudley Road in Birmingham as a welder. She was trained and she became a welder there. And they were welding munitions, you know, for to go to the front. So I suppose she felt she was playing some kind of a part. I don't know what she felt. But anyway, as I say, 3 or 4 years later, she married Bill Freeman.
What about her marriage? Was that a successful marriage?
Oh, yeah. She had two children by that marriage. But my mother was a workaholic as well as I am. And, you know, I inherited this. It's a curse, but I inherited it. And she worked two jobs, I remember. The first time I remember meeting my mother, that might be of interest to you, was on Connolly Station, and I was 3 and a half. And I'll tell you, I never remembered the details of it. I always had thoughts about it, but I never remembered the details of it until I was quite ill when I was 54 years of age. I had a nervous breakdown from overwork and worry and concern and never dealing with my life in general. And at that time, I met this wonderful doctor, and he wouldn't let me go into hospital or anything. I just went into therapy with him. And he said to me, Vera, we have to live this life.
So he got you to go back and research the whole
thing. Yeah. And when I journaled on that, I remembered every detail of my first meeting with my mother.
Describe that to me.
Well, I remember there was a guy here in the village that had a car, Josie Duggan. He was a first cousin of my mother's. He had an old car at the time. And I remember not going to the station. I don't remember that at all. But I remember we were standing on the station, my aunt, Sheila, and my grandfather. And this train came in, and there was smuts and dirt flying everywhere, you know, because you know the way the smuts flew from those old trains. I remember all of that and the noise of it. And I remember hiding under my grandfather's coat because of the noise. And then the train started to empty, and there was hundreds of people on this platform. Like, I mean, as a child, I saw it as there was a kind of a flood of people jumped out of this train. And the next thing I remember was my aunt, who I would regard as a sister, a friend, and a mother to me. This is my mother's only sister, Sheila O'Neill, who was Sheila Walsh to begin with. She had her arms out like this, and this woman was running down the platform in a pair of high-heeled shoes and a green coat. And she had quite a red face, probably like mine at the moment. And she was galloping, but she was galloping towards this child. And I saw her coming, but I got between my grandfather's legs so that I could just see her coming down the platform. And I knew she was trying to make a fuss of me, but I mean, I wasn't having any of her now. I didn't know who she was. So we went into the cafeteria, as it was called then, on the station. And you know, they were talking away. I can't remember anything about the conversation or any of that, because I was engaged in the bag she was opening. And she took out of the bag a red beaker, as we know it now. But like, I thought it was kind of a glass or a cup or something, but it was red. And she put it on the table. And then she took out what looked like our sláinte bottles at the time, a mineral bottle. But it was full of milk. And she put some of this milk into this, and she was kind of, you know, slipping it over towards me while they were talking. And of course, I wasn't touching that either. But after a few minutes, when I thought nobody was looking, I picked up this glass and I had a drink of it, and it was absolutely gorgeous milk. Milk like I never tasted before. And I drank the milk anyway, and I looked over at her, and the next thing I remember about that was we were coming out in this car. Now, Mark, there was my mother, her husband, and my very new small brother, who was a little son, so I didn't like him. On sight, I didn't like him. And had she got a child there? No, that was the next visit.
Yeah.
No, because that was on the next visit. No, she would have been just with her husband, who had a limp and had a problem with his right arm. And very tall, very good-looking man. And looking at my father's photograph later, there was absolutely no resemblance whatsoever to my father. But anyway, the thing I remember about coming home in the car that day, and I don't remember the trip home, but I do remember, and Kittle remembered as well, we came up by into Old Kingswood, up by Steins's, where the Green Isle Hotel is now on the old road. And another car came down the road and nearly hit the car we were in. And Josie went up on the ditch. And I remember that as well as if it was yesterday. Now, he got out and he was, Josie Duggan, like he was shouting and roaring at this fella and if he'd have got him. Now, nobody was hurt or anything, you know, and I'd say he overreacted by hitting the ditch anyway, probably looking back on it now in hindsight. He was his nervous driving, and he had my mother, her new husband, my grandfather, my aunt, me and himself in the car. And like, I mean, cars weren't big them days, you know. I think it was in Austin or something he had. You'd remember that, Kit.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't remember anything about the rest of the journey. I don't remember much about them being home or anything at that stage.
Mm-hmm.
But the next visit, I remember distinctly. It was for my aunt's wedding in 1947.
What age were you then?
I was seven. I was seven then. And she was marrying a chap, Kit's next door neighbour, Larry O'Neill. They didn't go far them days to get partners. And they were married in the August of 1947. And I remember that morning I was all prim and proper in this lovely little pink dress and a pink bow. You always had a bow in your hair. And I was sent to Flynn's for something. And Flynn's lived one, two, three doors from our house. And while I was going down to them, I got a huge lump of crow droppings on my pink ribbon that caused a sensation. There wasn't another ribbon to be found. That's what I remember about the wedding.
Yes, the embarrassment of
it. That's the full sum total. And
at that stage, had you any idea that, was there any... warming between yourself and your mother? Did you see her as being your mother?
I was told she was my mother, like, you know, and then there was the little notes. My grandmother would be writing to her. She wrote to her regularly. And you know the way a kid would be scribbling notes. I was always encouraged to scribble the notes, and which I did. And would be looking for, like, there'd be great excitement in the house when she was coming home. Oh, there'd be scrubbing and tearing and putting up wallpaper and splashing paint and you name it. And there was always great joviality when she arrived.
Now, the few years that followed that, were you in any way put out by the fact that you didn't have a mother, you didn't have a father?
Oh, God, I was, yeah, because I got a lot of bullying because of it. Like, you know, but we didn't recognise it as bullying them days. You know, the thing was that 3 days before my mother would go back off the holiday, and remember, I didn't see her very often because I had to have sailing tickets then, and it wasn't easy to get a sailing ticket to come home from England at that stage. But my aunt's husband worked in the B&I, and the sailing ticket used to be acquired from Westmoreland Street's B&I, sent to Birmingham, and she'd get home maybe every 2 years or so. Like, I didn't see her every year. I didn't see her for First Communion, confirmation or anything like that. It would be holiday time. And like, she didn't have money then either. You know, she did a couple of house cleaning jobs and things like that in England, and he wasn't a big earner because of his disability, and that's how he wasn't in the war effort. He had polio. when he was a child, her husband. But anyway, what was I going to say? About 3 days before she'd be going back off these visits, there'd be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Everybody be fighting and everybody be crying, and there was, and I, of course, never knew what it was about. Never, ever knew what it was about. And nobody ever explained anything to me. Like, children were to be seen and not heard them times. Now, I used to hear great things from under the table, you know, when the tablecloth would be down over it. It was a great little tent. And I heard many a thing there. But, you know, kids can put two and two to make five. When something is not explained to you never know whether you're on the right track or not. But seemingly, I learned in later life that, you know, that was always when she wanted to take me back to England with her. And, of course, the grandparents wouldn't allow it.
Oh, I see. And so when there was a bit of a scuffle
over that.
There
was always friction. When I was eight, my grandmother had a stroke. And a couple of months, would have been 9 months after she had the stroke, we went to Birmingham together. Now, she was only affected on one side, but this was a mild stroke she had. And my mother insisted that she come over because my stepsister was born at that stage. And she will actually be 60 in June, my stepsister. And she was born and my mother couldn't come home. So she sent the money for the grandmother to go over and bring me with her. But I was going to mind her. You know, at eight, I was housekeeping because under my grandmother's very strict, you know, you do it this way and you don't do it that way. And she did all the directing and I did all the work, and I including going into Moore Street at that age on the bus for to get the shopping from the home in Cologne and to Martin's Butchers across the road for the meat. And it's a very funny incident about that too. I don't know what year Liberty Hall was built, but I was on one of these shopping expeditions at one stage and the grandfather said to me, what was it?
In the early 50s, that's a
51. They were building it then, yeah. But the grandfather said to me, if you ever miss the bus, the 69, go down to the White Elephant and get the IOC home, which was the long distance bus. So this one particular day, and now the traffic went up and down the same side of the Liffey at that stage, and this day I had missed the 69. And I crossed over and I got the bus down to the White Elephant, as I had been instructed to get it. And I waited in the queue for the Kildare bus, which was the IOC, they called it then. I don't know what that meant, but it was the company that the bus was at that stage.
Yeah.
And but when I got on the bus at Bachelor's Walk to go down to Liberty Hall, I got on the bus and the conductor had a yoke here, you know, and a bag here, and there was a bar on this end of the bus, like it wasn't very old buses. And he said, where are you going to, child? And I handed me tuppence and I said, to the White Elephant, whereupon everybody on the bus was in convulsions. I can remember it distinctly because everybody looked around and thought, you know, it must have been the biggest joke at the time that they were building this White Elephant. But anyway,
referring to the Liberty Hall. Liberty Hall at the time.
But
yes.
My grandfather called it a White Elephant, and so did I. I didn't know any different. But where are we now?
Well, at this stage in your life, you must have been what, about 14 or so?
I was 8 the first time I went to Birmingham.
Okay, but what about your schooling days then?
Well, I was going to school here in the village.
Yeah, but how did the other kids react to the fact that you didn't...
Well, it was always, why have you old parents? And tell us why you have old parents. You've no daddy. You never had a daddy. Where's your mammy? And I get all this in the schoolyard, you know. And I remember back to it, but you dealt with it at the time. And I suppose I dealt with it by eating Eileen McLaughlin's lunch on her. Because they had brown bread and they were from the Selby. And that was my way of dealing with it. That was my way of bullying back as a child. But anyway, we went to Birmingham and I remember when we were brought up to the centre of Birmingham, there was an unexploded bomb in the middle of the city with a big railing around it and people went to view it. And I remember the big hole and the crater that was there was ginormous to a small young one at that stage. I suppose it wasn't that big, but you had to really look into this hole.
So this was just after the war years?
Oh yeah, because the war ended in 45. And I remember that my mother had, she had, they were still on rations. And where she lived in the old end of Birmingham at that stage, it was like Coronation Street. And there was a little shop on that corner and a little shop on this corner. And the shop on this corner was a little child's clothes, it was everybody's clothes shop. But she had collected all her clothes coupons for when I went. And I remember she bought me a lovely dress when I got there in this little shop. And my stepbrother had this three-wheel bike, and they had, like, we were coming from here, there was grass in the middle of the road here, and there was no concrete paths, but there was slabs on the road, and you could belt along on this bloody three-wheel bike. I mean, I rode around the rims while I was there. I'd say there wasn't a bit of it left again. I got back from Birmingham. That was the greatest pleasure I had. And he whinged all the time I was on it, and I couldn't care. I didn't give a damn whether he whinged or not. And Diane, my stepsister, was a baby. She was only it would have been in the August of 48.
Yeah.
Because she will be 60 this June.
All right, so they were still
60 years
inside. So they were still cleaning up the city and
absolutely,
they were trying
to
get back to normal again.
Yeah.
What were your did you understand the, you know, that there had been a big war and that all these bombs had been dropped and
I heard all the talk about it, but it didn't attach much importance to it. I mean, there was only my mother's house and Betty next door that looked like houses. All the rest of them had corrugated tin in the windows, and like all one side of the street was completely flattened. And then there was a factory behind where a Mrs. Fields lived. And I remember we used to go in for afternoon tea to Mrs. Fields, which was a huge treat, you know, to go into this place. But I don't remember very much else about it, except the day that we went to see the bomb, my mother took us to the Bull Ring in Birmingham, which is a very famous place. And she bought me a little, she said to me, "Now, I'll buy you some little thing in here." And then I didn't know at the time she had money, but she wouldn't have had money. But we went around anyway, and there was fellas selling plates and cups and Delf and all kinds of things. And it was hilarious fun in it with these guys that was doing all this selling. And you may have seen years ago where they'd stand up and bang all the plates together, you know, and they'd be selling them, you know, a dozen at a time. It was really entertaining. And the only thing I wanted while I was in there was this little, it was a little dog, a little green and cream dog with black eyes and a red tongue hanging out. And it's as big as that. And I still have it.
And that's lovely.
Yeah. It fell at one stage, and I said to Sam, "Oh Jesus, I'm after breaking me dog." And he said, "It's nearly time that thing was thrown out." And of course, I said, I gave him down the banks, and I said, "My mother bought me that, and I wanted to keep it." And he said, "All right." I had a very patient husband. He sat down with a bit of glue, and he stuck it together perfectly. And it's still above in the press.
And that was a little present your mother bought you when you were down in the Bullring in Birmingham.
In 1948.
Now, you had to come home again.
Oh, yeah, we were only there for 2 weeks, and we came home again. And I was housekeeping at that stage and going to school. And my grandfather was great in the house. And he loved his garden. And I only found out 2 years ago that he was a gardener in the Botanic Gardens before he joined the army.
So
he worked in the botanical gardens. He was from Glasnevin, you see.
Yeah.
And when he joined the army, then he had to go to Belfast to do that. And he was a year too young for it, but he was a fine young fella. So the wrong name or the wrong age went down, and he went off, and he was in France, and he was in Burma, and he was all over the place in the British Army, and was very badly wounded. And he came back here and worked in Guinness's for a while. But he was always meticulous about the house, you know, it had to be kept right, and he was painting and decorating and somewhat as far as he could. I remember one time he painted the kitchen red and white. red and cream. And the bloody paint never dried. Jeez, we were all covered in paint. Do you remember? In them days, you didn't get decent paint, you know? Yeah. But it was a great joke.
And what was your mother's father's name?
Joe Walsh.
Joe. Yeah. And your grandmother's name was?
Katie Duggan.
Katie. So Joe actually fought in the First World War.
Oh, he did, yeah. Yeah. He did.
And he was a handyman around the house and that.
Oh, he loved it. Well, the fender was always done with an emery board, and the fire, the bit of coal she'd have in the cupboard would be lighting, the fire would be lighting from 6 o'clock in the morning. He was an early riser.
What about Kate Duggan then?
Katie Duggan was my grandmother.
And where was she from?
She was from Rathcoole.
Oh,
yeah,
yes.
And what I know of it, I don't know too much of the history, and I'd love to know it, but there's an old house in Rathcoole that, belonged to the Shields estate. And they were tenants on the Shields estate. It was a long, narrow, thatched house. And I used to have to go every day with my grandmother over to her mother, who was a very old woman at that time, and a contrarian woman you never met in your life. And I'd have to go down to the butcher's, to Lockie Hayden's, and get her meat and whatever messages she wanted while my mother did her housework. And we'd walk there and walk back. Mm-hmm. Now, it was a short walk them days. Like, the roads have all changed. The village has totally changed what it was then. And we were very close. There was very little difference between Sagard and Rathcoole at that time. Isn't that true, Kate?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we were all one. It was kind of...
a lot of relations.
Well, these were my great-grandparents that lived there.
Did any stories come down to you through your grandparents?
Through the Duggans.
Yes.
Well, they're buried at the feet, my father's feet, my Jim and Julia Duggan, my grandparents. And she was a Riley to begin with, I think. She'd be related to Paddy Riley, the ballad singer now. His grandfather and my great-grandmother, I think, were brother and sister. I'm not sure about this. But that's the connection there that I was always told about. But I know that my mother, my grandmother herself, her grandfather was quite wealthy. And he was a bookie and an alcoholic. And he lost everything they had. They lived on near Island Bridge. You know those trees, as you go up to the park, they have those houses with big steps up to them.
Yeah, yeah.
They lived there. And she remembered being wheeled by her governess in the park, in the Phoenix Park. But then he drank it out and lost everything they had. And that's when they came to Rathcoole.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And so growing up there with your grandparents, did you take an interest in the stories about the way Sagard was
absolutely.
Going way back in the early part of the last century?
Yeah, and I've tried to capture some of it in this research that I've written. I'll give you a copy of that.
Yeah, that's your grandfather. Was he working at the time?
He was in the mill. He was a watchman in the mill. And I remember I used to pair his cordons and cut his toenails and rub his back with this liniment he had, because he wasn't very strong either. And I actually know now that this couple kept me for themselves. They kept me to look after them, which I did. I left school when I was 13, 12 and a half to 13, for a year to mind my grandmother and lived beside Betty up in Crookshane, up in Rathcoole, where my aunt had gone to live with her family. And she lived next door to Betty's aunt.
That's how I met Kate.
So that's how you met, So kind of Rathcoole would have been played a big part in your life then.
Oh, really? Absolutely. Yes, always. Yeah. Always did. I knew everybody in Rathcoole. And as I'd walk round down Rathcoole today, I can still see it exactly as it was then, and all the characters that was in it. The same as we can here with the village. Like, I mean, we'd lots of characters as well. But I left school that time to help to mind my mother, my grandmother. She was always my mother. You know, I didn't refer to her as my grandmother. She was Mammy, and that was it. But as Betty will tell you, she had 13 months of a very hard death. She was 13 months. She couldn't. The only word she could say was Vera. And as a small child at that time, I remember when she died, it was ringing in my ears for years afterwards. And I used to sleep on a little settee bed beside her in the bedroom. I was terrified, absolutely terrified.
And so she died when you were still quite young?
I was 13 and a half when she died, 14. That'd be about right, Betty. Yeah.
And did you continue to look after your granddad then in the house?
When she died and was buried, she died in the July of 1954. I was 14. And my aunt came back to live in the house here in Saggart. Not because she wanted her, but because her husband wanted her. He wanted to be near the job. And he was getting older, he said, and he wouldn't be able to ride in a bike over to Saggart and all the rest of it. So, yeah, we should go back. But my grandfather never liked her husband. They never got on. And he wanted me to go back to the house with him. Now, you see, there was a lot of complications in our house here in Mill Road. First of all, I was there, the granddaughter. There was two nephews. My grandfather's two nephews were reared there because their mother died on the birth of her eighth child.
And they adopted two of them?
They took one of them at that stage. And then their father died 2 years later and the other guy came to live with his then. But they were always there for me.
Right, so
they were always brothers to me. Oh, very full house. As well as that, they took home another niece of my grandfather's who was in Stevens's hospital, and she had a TB hip, and they took her out of hospital and nursed her for the guts of 2 years. And she met her husband here in Saggart too, Fred Gray. And then there was the two lads that lived in the house were Tom and John Walsh, the same name as the grandfather, because it was the grandfather's brothers. These were the grandfather's brothers' children. Five of them stayed at home, and the eldest one reared them herself, and the youngest one was taken to be reared by my grandfather's sister out in Glasnevin.
Right, yes.
So, you know, yeah. All of that. But we had the two lads, Tom and John, and they came to live with the grandparents before I did.
Yeah.
So they were always my brothers. You know, and there were two great lads, and they both died very young as well. And I remember John used to say, not one in my family lived to be 60, and I won't either. And he was 60 on the 12th of September, and he died on the 25th.
Well, now, isn't that?
And Tom was
something, yeah.
His other brother died at 54, leading out his son's horse.
Feel it that you were being pushed and shoved from all
absolutely.
Directions?
Oh, absolutely, and so did they.
Yeah.
Like we didn't have a normal. It wasn't a normal family house.
But you had time to observe and watch and see what was going on.
Yeah.
What about the characters up there in Rathcoole when you were growing up?
Well, there was the Quinns where we went to play cards. And Ounce Quinn, they called this man. He was a very, very stout man. Small in stature, but very stout. I remember like a tummy like this. So they called him Ounce. So that's a sign of the humour that went with it. And he married Rose. And we had several names on Rose. I wouldn't relate any of them if I could remember them myself. But anyway, they used to come to Saggart to play cards. And Jim Connolly and Mary. And but even before that, the longest memory I have of our house was that we had a radio that my grandfather used to take the battery out of and put it on the back of his bike, tie it on the back step of the bike and bring it over to the garage to get it charged, particularly when there was a match coming on. And everybody on our road would be sitting out on the path with this radio blaring with Michael O'Hare roaring his lungs out with Dublin and Kerry and the cheering and the clapping and the going mad while this match would be on.
Yeah.
And then after the match, the lads would be kicking tin cans up and down the road. I'm sure you remember that. It wasn't too many footballs.
Hoops.
But they'd all be playing a match then at that stage. There might be newspapers rolled up, you know, and tied up with string, and that would be a football as well. So I remember those occasions. And of course, we all played hopscotch on the road, and we played up again the walls with towns and all the rest of it. That we were a very close-knit group. And we could run in and out of everybody's house from number 1 to 22.
Up in Raccoon.
In Saggart.
Oh, in Saggart.
Mill Road, Saggart.
Yeah. And while you were here in Mill Road, did you notice how, talking about this closely knit community, how that people would support one another,
would
help one another if they were down? And have you any example of that?
Well, my grandfather's garden was always tilled. You wouldn't see a weed that size in it. And as I say, I never knew till a few years ago that he was a gardener in the Botanic Gardens. But we'd have to, like, if there was, you'd be collecting cow manure to mix with leaves, and everything had to be put into a bank for this potato dropping. I remember dropping the potatoes, cutting them on the eye and dropping them in the drills, sowing cabbages, sowing onions, scallions, everything came out of the garden. And we had to be self-sufficient. You know, that you'd be summoned if you had a garden with weeds in at that time, because it was after the war and everybody had to be self-sufficient. Isn't that right, Kit?
Farmers would have to cut the thistles and everything.
Yeah.
Gardens would be going around. If there was thistles on your land, you got orders to cut them.
Yeah. And I remember the wagger, Danny Burden, with a machine out of Campbell's, going round, and it had a spinner on it, you know, and he'd be going round the fields cutting these weeds. You know, the long weeds with the yellow tops on them. What do you call them?
Ragwort.
Yeah. Loads of that.
But did your father then go around and help other people?
My grandfather.
Your grandfather, and do other people's gardens?
No. No, he never did,
but
no.
Was there any...
The best thing he was able to do was, when he came home from work, was throw his leg over the bike and go over to May Doolan to Newcastle for his few pints. And then he went up to Lyons Estate, Lord Luncurry's Hill. It's Lyons Estate now. It's owned by, I think, UCD. He was a friend of the gardeners up there.
Ryan, the man that died recently, the owns...
And my grandfather was a friend of the gardener up there. And he used to go up there to buy tomatoes.
Up in the estate,
right? Up in the estate, yeah. But it was another excuse for going for a few pints in Newcastle.
He used to bring the tomatoes, the green tomatoes.
That's right.
She used to make the green tomato chutney.
That's
and
right.
Your grandfather used to bring them to
her. That's right. And he'd have the, we had kind of windows that went up and down. They were, what did they call them?
The sash
windows. And the green tomatoes would be put along the top of the sash windows, you know, for to ripen them. Because he'd get all these small tomatoes, you know. I suppose, like, they were, like, you'd be buying windfalls in apples. He'd get apples as well. So there'd be seconds. But, I mean, as you say, your Aunt Ada, she
green tomatoes.
Yeah.
And in the 50s...
And no, his garden was always tilled, but there was a guy lived in number 22, and I won't mention names, but there was 10 kids down there, and she was a wonderful woman, but he was a gas egg. And I suppose God helped him in his way. He was a bit of an alcoholic as well. Never worked. She worked day and night and reared the kids and always had a smile on her face. She was a gorgeous little woman. And I never saw or heard him doing anything wrong, but I used to hear the stories when I'd be under the table. The gom sold another tree today. During the war, if you could sell a tree to somebody, like for a farden, because there was no coal or anything, like, people would pay you for it, pay you good money for it. But he never had any trees. But he'd sell you a tree, and he'd sell Betty one, and he'd sell Kit one, and he'd sell us one. And he'd drink the money, and there'd be murder because nobody ever got a tree. But he was gas, and he with the grandfather till in the garden, every now and again he'd send a sack up to our house for a few vegetables. Now, a sack would be like sacking material, you know.
And quite a large sack, yeah.
Yeah, and that would come up for a head of cabbage, a couple of turnips, and he'd get both, you know, whatever would be in the garden, they get that. That was a support.
Yeah.
And then we'd another man live two doors from us, and he worked in the camp, Martin Phelan, and he was our doctor. He was a first aid man in Baldonnell camp, and no matter what happened, any kid on the road, you went to Martin Phelan, because he'd have old plasters and bandages, and he'd doctor us and what have you. So he was the doctor on the road. And, you know, I suppose all these people that lived on the road had some, they had some bearing on my life as a child. Well, you know, you had that freedom with them, and they all knew who you were. And, like, I mean, at the time, I wouldn't have been aware that they knew my story, and I didn't know my story myself.
Yeah.
You know, but, didn't matter. I was one of the villagers, and that was it.
Even though things weren't great in the 50s and 60s, money was very scarce. So you had nothing. But, you know, were you content? Were you happy? Were people generally in the village, were they content and happy?
As long as you told the lion. You had to toe the line.
In what way now?
Well, I had a grand aunt that lived in number two. And, oh God, I should have brought you down. I wrote a story about her too. She was a wonderful individual. Tough nut. Bluest language ever you heard. She was the dressmaker for the area. She made first communion, confirmation, wedding dresses, dance dresses, turned coats inside out for kids. And the minute you'd walk in the door, you'd get a job. Here you are, child, rip that coat, rip that seam, whatever. On Pancake Tuesday, I remember she'd make the pancake stuff in a bucket, and we'd be all whipping, and she'd start making pancakes at 10 o'clock in the morning. She had 8 sons and 2 daughters, and he died when he was 48, and he was an ex-British Army man as well. Big, handsome man. He was in the Guards, the Irish Guards, and he came home crippled with arthritis, and of course as mad as a brush. They were all a bit mad because of the coming home, they were shell-shocked and everything. But like another guy that lived on the road, Luke Attlee, he was an ex, and Paddy Mann, they were all in the British Army, and they were all a bit shell-shocked, you know, and they had their own old odd ways.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
like, totally accepted by everybody. But
going back to that woman again.
And my aunt Kathleen Duggan, she was the village seamstress, as I say, and she reared them kids with a rod of iron. But she never missed out on anything. Like Christmas, there'd be puddings flying for a month before Christmas. She'd have stacks of them. Because them lads, they were all over 6 foot in the ditch herself, as we say in Saga. Yeah. But like, whatever the occasion, she was in there. And then I remember as they all went to work, I used to help Doreen, her daughter, to cut the lunches. And the baker would go in with a whole tray of loaves. Like, there was no wrapping on the bread them days. A whole tray of loaves. And there we'd be with blunt knives cutting bread. The lads would stick them inside here when they'd be going off to work on building sites or out to work with the farmers in the morning. But anything I ever wanted to know about my life, my history, whatever it was, I'd ask the Aunt Kathleen. And you got it in its very rawest terms. I never was in any doubt when I'd ask her a question. And not alone did I get my end of it, but I got her involvement in it, and who involved her in it, and why she was involved in it. And Kit's laughing because he can understand it completely. This was a big, tough woman. That had to be tough.
And generally, with that particular woman anyway, was there quick wit? And
oh, absolutely.
Oh, she was, yeah.
And she'd make a cat laugh. And my grandmother's outings were, when they were talking now, when there was no argument, she went up to her at night for a chat. And all the time you'd be there, she'd be working and I'd be working and everybody else in the house, was nobody, you didn't sit idle around Kathleen Duggan. There was things to be done and you did it. And you did it her way, just like my grandmother. You know, there were strict disciplinarians and you got a belt in the air if you didn't do it right, or a kick in the backside that would lift you off the top step. But
they had to.
Oh yeah, that was it.
Because they would, you know, it was the only way of making it.
But that's all they knew.
And to meet, yeah, to meet end.
That's all they knew. Yeah. I think I hammered my own eldest lad because I thought that was the way you did it. He was a little devil, and like, he wasn't behind the dog getting a good wallop, and if he needed it, like, I mean, now I would be totally horrified if I saw somebody hitting a child. But I did it with my eldest lad. I never did it with the other two. Because one day, you know, he was blamed for something, and I gave him a good hammering and put him to bed. And then the woman next door came in and said, it wasn't his fault at all. He wasn't involved. I saw it out through the window. And I said, as long as I live, I will never put my hand on my kids again. Or I never did. Now, I wasn't killing him, but he was getting a good slapping for being a bold boy. And I wouldn't do that now for all the tea in China to any child. That's why my grandchildren are ruined.
Your dad, Jack Rice.
Yeah.
Did you ever look him up, or did you ever kind of?
One of my cousins, one of his sister's sons, he's a guard, Brian Nolan. He started to do the history, the genealogy. And every time I meet him, and I'll meet him again now on Patrick's night, because my father's eldest sister that's alive, she's 87. Her husband will be 90 on Patrick's day.
Did you ever go down and meet the family?
Oh, yeah, I did. Hated going near any of them.
Why?
Because I said to you at the beginning of this that my grandmother's cousin lived 5 doors from my grandmother, as it turned out. And her name was Maggie Fardell. And Gerard Fardell was my father's pal. They went to school together. They grew up together, you know. And it was through my mother being in Maggie Farrell's house that she met Jack Rice, my father. And when my father was dead and gone, and I went to see Maggie Fardell with my grandmother, who lived with my grandmother, Katie Walsh, we went to Fardell's. But my grandmother, my father's mother, lived 5 doors from that. Maggie Fardell lived in number 15 Fossa Road, Cabra, and my grandmother lived in number 23 Fossa Road.
Right.
And I never liked going up to her house because my father was the third eldest of 10 and all his sisters were in the rag trade, and they'd say, where did you get that dress from? Oh, look at the state of that. And what kind of shoes are they? And say this for me and say that for me. And I got an awful jeering over my accent. And I hated the sight of them. I used to go to Aunt Maggie Fardell's, as I called her then. She wasn't an aunt of mine. She was my grandmother's first cousin. But she was a lovely woman.
But tell me now about your accent. Would you say that that's definitely a Saggart accent? Or would you?
This one here, yes.
It's a country accent, yeah. Actually,
and
the people that lived in
Dublin. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. They were kind of, my grandmother was a very articulate type of a person herself, and she believed that they spoke properly. All their children are well educated and went to elocution lessons. And you know, as my cousins came along, because I've cousins around the same age as myself, and they all had lovely plaits and, you know, dancing costumes and elocution lessons, and I used to think, oh Jesus, what am I doing out here? So when I'd go with my grandmother from here, I went to Maggie Fardell's.
Yeah.
But my grandmother then, 5 doors up the road, would say, Maggie Fardell used to say to me, you better go up and see your granny. Oh, when she sees me now, I'll be yet, because you were here and you didn't go up to see her. So I'd be watching the clock and I'd say, I might go up now, they'll be gone back to work. The girls all rode their bikes to wherever they were working and the lads wouldn't be there. And I'd go up anyway, and my grandfather, Jack Rice as well, was a stonemason. And the one thing that fascinated me as a very small child was he made my father's headstone, which is a pure Celtic cross. And I played on that piece of granite, Wicklow granite, as he chiseled it all those years ago. And it is absolute perfection. And he used to say to me, do you see this now, child? This is a true Celtic wheel. This is a true Celtic cross. There's no adding on to this. I'm boring this as I'm doing it. And he taught me lots of little things, little tricks of the trade. And when he came out, I was very fond of him because they had an old Joanna, as they called it, in the parlour that would have been used as a bedroom when my father was dying. And he loved music, and it was a musical house. My grandmother was a lovely singer as well, and all the girls were nice singers. But when I'd go in, he'd sit me on his lap and he'd play "Roll Out the Barrel," you know. And I absolutely loved this, you know. And I loved this grandfather, but he wasn't very popular in his own house because he took a few pints. And there was always a tension there between him and the grandmother. And there was always a tension there between the family, until eventually, when they were very old, the two of them, they bought a new house for her and took her away and left him on his own. And he sold that house and he went to live in a little apartment up in Gardner Street, and that's where he died. Nice. And I never knew he was dying or I would have been beside him. But the day that my husband and I were getting engaged, I was 18. And we were standing in Henry Street at the jeweller's there. Can't remember the name of it now. It was just beside the arcade at Woolworths. And we were looking in the window, going to look in the window at the rings.
Yeah.
And Sam was turning over the few shillings he had in his pocket and hoping to Jesus I wouldn't like one of them, I suppose, if the truth was known, because we had buttons. And as we were standing there, there was this old man with a stick. And I said to Sam, "That's me granda." And he said, "Quiet with that, it's not your granda." I said, "It is me granda." I could see his face, you know, in the window. Excuse me for just one second. I could see his face in the window, and I said to him, "Hello, granddad." And he turned round and he said, "Hello, child, how are you? Did you see your old mad granny yet lately?" And, you know, I never saw him after that until I attended his funeral. And that was the year that my second son was born. And Tony is 45 this year. And I was pregnant when he died. And I went to his funeral that night in Gardner Street Chapel.
Yeah.
And his eldest son, my father's eldest brother, rang me that day. I was living up on the side of the hill, and he said, "We want to bury my father with your father." And because I loved this old man, I agreed. I said, "Okay then, you know." And the nine Ergles used to dig, another character from the village used to dig the graves here. And he was waiting above at the post office with Mary Birmingham, who was in charge of the graveyard, and she was the postmistress, with the shovel to go down and dig the grave, my father's grave, for to bury his father in it. And Mary Birmingham said, "Did you hear from that man?" She said, "Because, you know, he didn't ring me back." Now, I didn't like this uncle, although he was my godfather and all the rest of it. I didn't like any of them at that time. But she rang him anyway, and he said, "Oh, it's all right." He said, "We're burying him out in Sutton." Now, the grave might as well have been dug. But when I went that night to the grave, to the funeral in Gardner Street, I was heavily pregnant with Tony at the time. And that uncle, my godfather, turned around and he said to me, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I've every right to be here. This is my grandfather and I'm here with respect for him." And he said, "You shouldn't have came all the way in here and you're pregnant and all the rest of it." And I said to him, "You should have rung me back about my father's grave." And he said, he's getting buried in consecrated ground," as if he was an old dog. And, you know, I kind of never forgave him for that. And then my grandmother went to live in his house, my father's mother. And she too had a stroke and was incapacitated. And I used to go to see her once a month there. And I never liked going to, because it was his house. And I was in England living when she died, because Sam and I moved out of Sagart for a while when the mill was going down, and we went, and my mother was very ill at the time because her husband died at 48, her second husband.
Yeah.
Died very suddenly, and she had a bit of a nervous breakdown after it, and I went over to look after her. And I had, my daughter was born over there. And I thought, home I'd never get. I went to Birmingham on the 23rd of April, 1966. And I come home because a guy here in the village, Ned Timmins, said, they're building houses, Vera. And he wrote to me monthly and took me, kept my name on the list for a house. He said, don't be 12 months away. So we went on the 23rd of April, 1966, and I came home on the 22nd of April, 1967, with my 6 weeks old baby, Louise, my third child.
And no, your husband's name was?
Anthony Crofton. Sam, Anthony. Known as Sam.
Yeah, and was he a local man here?
He was from Newcastle, and his is another whole story that I could go on for a month about.
But you met here?
We met, Kit had a hill man at the time, and he was driving us to the dances. And I went in the hill man with Kit. I was home from Birmingham. I was after spending a few months with my mother as well, where I got a little bit of education. I got 9 months of education, but couldn't stand living with her. Mm-hmm. And we fell out on very bad terms. I came home, and I went to the dance in Newcastle Hall, and this little guy danced with me all night. And I went the following week, and he danced with me again. That was during the holiday. Went back to Birmingham and on a Friday, and my grandfather said to me, you're not happy over there. You come home to me. You're not happy with that woman. She's trying to rear you now, and you're too old to be reared, which was all quite true. Yeah. And I was about 16 and a half at the time. And I walked in. My mother said, you're not going back home to him now. And there was a row straight away when I got off the bus. And I said, I am going home to him. And I sent him a telegram. He telegrammed back the money to me. And I came back home from Birmingham on the Tuesday of the next week. And I never went to Birmingham again for years. But that's when I met my husband. Went in Kit's car to the dance in Newcastle and come home on his Excelsior motorbike. And we never lost track of each other after that.
Well, you were so young. You were
Sam was 8 and a half years older than me.
Oh, was he? No.
Yeah. He was 8 and a half years older than me.
But you were still, you were still a teenager.
Oh, indeed I was. I was 16 and a half when I met him. And I was married at 20.
Oh, were you? Yeah.
Yeah. And he was a very special person in my life and still is, although he's 12 years dead now since January. But, I don't think I'd be here today only for him.
That's really?
Telling yes, you quite yeah. bluntly. He was my healer in every sense of the word.
No. And yeah, so the Rices are the... your father's people.
That was another thing about the schoolyard. How could, half of the people in Sagard called me Vera Walsh, or Welsh, as it was pronounced them days. And how could you be Vera Rice when you're living in Walsh's? And, and I never knew who I was.
Yeah.
I quite frankly never knew who I was. I never knew my true identity. I didn't like the people that I would be coming from. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I look forward to going out to see them. I have three owl aunts and they're all well in their 80s and they're a scream. But, and I've one uncle left. And the uncle that was my godfather, he retired from the civil service at 60.
Yeah.
And his wife had a brother in South Africa who was a priest. And they went to South Africa for 6 months. And they were touring in South Africa. And they went down one morning onto the beach at 7:30 for their swim, came back up at 8:30, and crossing the road, he was killed with a car. Three young fellas in a stolen car, three black boys, ran him down in South Africa, in Johannesburg. So I never did get to know him or like him, but, that was...
Well, Vera Rice Welsh Crofton, it was a pleasure. And what a story. What a fascinating story.
This is why Dr. Michael Corrie wanted me to write it.
Yeah.
Because I did all this.
Well, I'm very happy that I recorded it because it's such such an important story to tell. Mm. Thank you very much.
I actually didn't think you were going to have that end of it. I thought we were going to talk about the village.
Yeah. But it's perfect. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.